Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carrie Wickham, who's a professor of political science at Emory University, specializing in politics of developing countries with a regional focus on the Middle East. Her current research examines the origins of political opposition in authoritarian settings, focusing on the rise of Islamic activism in Egypt and other Arab states. She's the author of The Muslim Brotherhood, Evolution of an Islamist Movement, and her latest article at the New York Times is Egypt's Missed Opportunity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carrie Wickham.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And to sort of summarize your article in Sunday's New York Times, my take on it, Carrie, was that, first of all, we don't know very much about the Muslim Brotherhood. We don't know about their history. We don't know about the age difference between those that began the movement and the younger generation and the splits within the movement. So give us your summary, if you will, of all of the above.
Well, I think you're right to begin with the point that there is a tremendous amount that we don't fully understand about the internal workings of this very important organization in Egypt. For good reasons, this is a group that has tried to stay under the radar to protect itself from repression and has been understandably reluctant to share information about its membership, its finances, and its leadership with outsiders. That being said, in the research that I've conducted over the past 23 years on the group, I have, come to the realization that this is a large umbrella organization that encompasses a wide spectrum of opinion. And we can discern three main trends within the group. The first is the old guard, which is an insular group of veteran leaders who are closely bonded by their long years of sacrifice for the movement, often having spent 10 or even 20 years in prison or in exile. And this is the group that has maintained control over the Brotherhood's Executive Council or Executive Bureau, from the beginning. And they tend to be quite ideologically conservative. That is, they still tend to support the application of traditional Islamic rulings inherited from the past, and also tend to remain very sort of aloof from and suspicious of outsiders. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we see what I call the reformist trend in the movement that has come to embrace more progressive interpretations of Islam that privilege ideas of pluralism, democracy, and human rights, and also have gained extensive experience interacting with secular democratic leaders and groups in broader spheres of public life, such as the professional associations, and come to see those others not as adversaries, but as potential partners in the broader tasks of political and social reform. And then in between those is an intermediary group that I call the pragmatic conservatives, who are closer ideologically to the old guard, but have greater experience in the wider political arena, for example, having served as Brotherhood deputies in Parliament for many years. And that group includes Mohamed Morsi, Sadiq Khatatni, the head of the Freedom and Justice Party, and many other leading figures in the Brotherhood today, in the public arena. And while we know that there are these different trends, what is harder to know is what level of support any one of those trends has within the organization, and why certain ideas gain traction among what types of members and why. That's something that we really still have very limited information on.
Well, what I learned from your article, though, Carrie Wickham, was that the three moderates that you mentioned, Essam Sultan, who was the Brotherhood's liaison, if you will, to the lawyer syndicate, mm-hmm. Abul Fatur, who was a medical doctor, and then finally Mr. Mahdi, who was with the engineers syndicate, they've gone off to form new parties. My recollection of the back to the election that elected Morsi was that there were other candidates that many saw as being more favorable in terms of a Brotherhood candidate. Were any of them on this liberal wing that you've identified here?
Well, what's interesting is that it was Abdelmenem Abu Fatul, the figure from the medical syndicate, who early on offered to run as president and pitched himself as someone who could bridge the Islamist-secular divide. But the Brotherhood senior leadership, regards him as ideologically, too progressive, too liberal in his views. And they ultimately threatened him with expulsion if he went forward in in running himself as a candidate for president, which he had planned to do as an independent. And he, you know, decided to move forward with that, and he was actually expelled from the group. And at the time, the Brotherhood's reasoning was, well, we promised that we would not run our own candidate for president. So if we supported Abu Futuh, we would be breaking our promise. But then, ironically, in the spring of 2012, the Brotherhood decided to run a candidate up from, you know, within its own close coterie of ideological conservatives for the post of president. And what's interesting about that decision is that it generated tremendous debate within the Brotherhood itself, with the more reformist voices saying, we can't do this. If we run, you know, one of our own top conservatives, you know, first of all, we will have lost all credibility because we will be violating our promise. And, you know, we're going to, you know, create a lot of, you know, dissension and distrust in the broader public. And the decision was put to a vote, and by a very narrow margin, the Shura Council, or the Brotherhood Legislative Assembly, decided to move forward with running a Brotherhood candidate for president. But as I say, that was a very controversial move. And you can imagine how different things might have been had the Brotherhood honored its initial promise not to run its own candidate and instead had supported one of the what are known as the third way candidates, those that are clear alternatives to both the Brotherhood and the old regime, such as Abdelmadjid Abu Futuh, a progressive Islamist, or Hamdine Sabahi, a secular leftist Democrat, who together won more votes than either Mohamed Morsi or Ahmed Shafiq in the first round, but split the vote between them. And as a result, a figure from the old regime and a figure from the Muslim Brotherhood are the two candidates that move forward to the presidential runoff. And, you know, many people that I spoke to in Cairo in the lead-up to that election described the choice between Morsi and Shafiq as one between cholera and the plague. So many who voted for Morsi were not voting for the Brotherhood. They were voting against a figure associated with the old order. And in fact, if you look at the data, it looks like about half of the people who voted for Morsi in the runoff chose a different candidate in the first round. So his mandate from the outset was actually far weaker than you know, many have been led to believe.
And of course, he was the last person to recognize that, apparently.
That's exactly right. So, you know, he acted as if he had, you know, the firm and, you know, backing of a strong majority of the population, when in fact that was never the case. And what he should have done from the outset was to, you know, reach out to other sectors of the opposition under Mubarak, whether in the form of, you know, setting up a national unity government or encouraging key secular figures to participate in a cabinet, or including a broader cross-section of opinion on the commission set up to write Egypt's new constitution. But instead, he, you know, chose to govern in close consultation with a small group of Brotherhood loyalists and gave the impression, rightly or wrongly, but gave the impression that the Brotherhood was using the powers of the presidential office for partisan gain, and that it was attempting to monopolize power. And, you know, I'm not sure if I fully accept that characterization, but neither did Morsi make a strenuous enough effort to counteract, you know, that impression.
And clearly the missed opportunity is what you just described, that the elections that elected Morsi as a fallback, a compromise candidate, and people had to hold their nose on the, at least on the secular and progressive side, the very people who brought about the revolution, because the socialist candidate narrowly missed the runoff, and as did the progressive Islamist candidate, Mr. Futuh. So could you make the case that had that not happened, we wouldn't be having this violence in the streets today?
Absolutely. I think if the third way, which is those who best represent the spirit of the uprising, both on the, you know, both sides of the Islamist secular divide, because you have progressive Islamists like Abu Futuh, who are deeply, I would argue, committed to the principles of democracy and human rights, but within an Islamic frame of reference, and then people like Hamdi Sabahi and other secularists, and those are figures and groups that could have worked together and that, in retrospect, should have joined forces and run one of them as president and one as vice president and, you know, some sort of formulation, but run together against the forces of the old order and against the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think in that case, they would have won. I mean, again, if you look at the data and you add up the percentage of votes that they received together, it is significantly more than what either Morsi or Shafiq won on his own. And yes, we would be in a completely different situation. But we would also be in a completely different situation if Mohamed Morsi, like Rashid El-Ghannouchi, who is the leader of Ennahda in Tunisia, had put the priority of national reconciliation first, rather than using the powers of his office to install Brotherhood loyalists within key agencies of the state and, you know, give the impression that he was excluding other groups. But I'll mention one key difference between Egypt and Tunisia, which made the prospects for national reconciliation made it much more difficult to achieve in Egypt, and that is the strong presence of the Salafi current in Egypt. And it's important to remember that the group that came in second in parliamentary elections was not the secular democratic opposition, but hardline Salafi Islamists. And this, I would say, placed Morsi from the outset in a very difficult position after he assumed the presidency. Because on the one hand, he could not come across as being too concessionary to secular demands, because then he could be accused of having betrayed the Islamic cause. And at the same time, you know, he was being watched and scrutinized closely by secular liberals, who are quick to accuse him of attempting to restrict civil liberties in the name of religion. So when you have such a deeply divided society and such a broad ideological spectrum, with hardline Islamists on one end and secular liberals on the other, you can see that it becomes extremely difficult to forge a national consensus on the type of political order that the country should have moving forward.
Well, Kerry Wickham, though, the Al-Nur, the Salafist party, came out of nowhere, and in large part because of massive funding from Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And it was also clear back in the original election that brought Morsi as a compromise candidate to the fore against a reactionary candidate. It's almost like that was working with the old guard's playbook, and that Morsi has simply fulfilled the old guard's playbook by being so boneheaded. And a lot of people are suggesting now that this revolution or counter-revolution was largely financed. In fact, one of the old guard, Mubarak's owners of the media, basically said he was responsible for Temurod, the group that got the, 22 million signatures on a petition. So how much is the old guard, the Mubarak era media, and the Saudis involved in reactionary politics?
Well, you know, it's certainly, you know, they say politics makes strange bedfellows, but it's certainly a very odd alliance, to say the least, between, you know, the conservative Saudi Islamist government, figures associated with the Mubarak regime, and, you know, in the form of media moguls and very wealthy businessmen, and then, you know, the secular opposition, the secular Democrats, who represent, you know, the genuine spirit of the uprising, which was, you know, a call for a democratic restructuring of politics and society, and a restoration of human dignity. So, you know, what do they have in common? Opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood, in opposition to, a sense of profound unease about the prospects of the Brotherhood assuming power, though for very different reasons. And I think that's a real, very important point, that, you know, many of the Mubarak appointees in the judicial establishment and in the military are less concerned with the preservation of, you know, potential threats to democracy as they are to potential threats to their own prerogatives and privileges. So, you know, their concerns are very different than those of, you know, democratic revolutionaries who have risked their lives to enlarge the freedom, you know, enjoyed by all citizens in the country. So I think that it's a problematic coalition that, you know, will very soon fall apart. It's already beginning to fray as secular liberals, people like Baradei, are looking at what the military is doing, using lethal force to shoot Brotherhood demonstrators in the head, and, you know, saying this is not what we wanted, mm-hmm. And this is not good for the country. And I happen to agree with Bassam Youssef, who has been described as Egypt's John Stewart. I don't know if you're familiar with
him. Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, but he wrote a great article recently that I read, and in it he says, you know, I'm very disappointed in my fellow liberals. You know, you guys, we need, stop gloating and start recognizing, we all need to start recognizing the humanity in each other. You know, the Brotherhood, you know, supporters, they, you know, we may not agree with them, and Morsi may not have been terribly effective in power, but they are still a significant component of our society, and to demonize them is not only unfair, but also puts our country at risk.
Well, of course, just to touch on the last point, though, the al-Nur leaders were standing shoulder to shoulder with General Sisi when the coup was announced. So, and I think they've lost quite a lot of respect, haven't they, or popularity, not that they had any traction with the liberals.
I think that both the liberals and the Nur party have, you know, lost a certain degree of democratic credibility by appearing to have, if not actively colluded with the military, at least tacitly endorsed the military's intervention that disrupted the democratic process. But at the same time, I think that the Brotherhood has to bear some responsibility for its own demise, because Morsi had numerous opportunities before June 30th, before the Tamarod had, you know, planned these huge demonstrations, to de-escalate the tensions. For example, there was a major cabinet shakeup in May when Morsi could have reached out to leaders in the secular opposition and said, come join, let's join forces, and let's put resolving, you know, addressing the dire problems of the country first above any kind of partisan competition. And he did not. In fact, you know, the resulting cabinet was sort of more of the same, more technocrats and more Islamists. And I remember reading at the time that Amr Moussa, who is a key figure in the opposition National Salvation Front, said, you know, given the dire situation that our country is in, Mr. Morsi, don't you think it's time for us to set aside our ideological and partisan differences and join hands and work together? And my worry is that, you know, that opportunity may have been missed, at least for, you know, the foreseeable future, because the country's become so polarized now. The Brotherhood doesn't want to work with the secular liberals. You know, the liberals are gloating about their victory over the Brotherhood. The military appears to be on a witch hunt and is, you know, tracking down Brotherhood leaders and, you know, trying to basically incapacitate the organization. And the biggest losers, unfortunately, are the Egyptian citizens who sacrificed so much for their freedom and now face the needless trauma of a prolonged conflict.
Well, just in closing, Carrie Wiggum, I spoke yesterday with Robert Fisk of The Independent, who's in Cairo, and he was covering the demonstrations and saying that everybody holding up pictures of General Sisi seemed affluent and middle class, and everybody holding up pictures of Morsi were poor. And we've always heard that from day one, that the Brotherhood's real traction is in the poorer communities and in the rural communities, as is the case, for example, in Iran for the Supreme Leader and other conservative Islamists. So why is it then that the left in Egypt wasn't able to win over the working class?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a longer story, you know, that, you know, we have to sort of go back.
Well, we only got a minute.
Right. But, a couple things. You know, first, the working class in Egypt and the poor in Egypt are deeply conservative religiously, and for them, you know, a political message based on Islam resonates very powerfully. But I want to make, I think, an important point, which is, yes, the lower middle classes and lower classes have historically supported Islamist groups, but if you look at the people out on the streets, those millions protesting against Morsi on June 30th and the days that followed, many of them, if not most of them, were also from the lower classes, because they have been the ones that have suffered the most from the continued deterioration in living conditions that has occurred under the Morsi regime. So, you know, it was not, you don't get, there were not 30 million secular liberals out there protesting. Those were ordinary citizens worried about how to feed their families, concerned because they can't find jobs, distraught by the deterioration in, you know, housing and the rise in fuel prices and garbage piling up in the streets. And so, you know, what they have discovered, for better or worse, is that the Brotherhood does not have any magic solution to those problems. And if we can think of any positive, you know, things to come out of this crisis, you know, one can only hope that something positive comes from it. It's that it brings the Brotherhood, you know, onto sort of a more level playing field with secular groups, and now maybe we can see a more healthy competition between them for the people's support that is based on their ability to address their real life problems.
So the temporal world intruded
yes.
on the spiritual world.
Yes.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Carrie Wickham.
It's my great pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Again, I've been speaking with Carrie Wickham, who's a professor of political science at Emory University, specializing in politics of developing countries with a regional focus on the Middle East. Her current research examines the origins of political opposition in authoritarian settings, focusing on the rise of Islamic activism in Egypt and other Arab states. She's the author of The Muslim Brotherhood, Evolution of an Islamist Movement, and her latest article in Sunday's New York Times is Egypt's Missed Opportunity. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time will pass.